Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwey, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Baba, 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 baba
Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, July 7th, 2012, we are broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. The Pan-African Journal last week was broadcasting remotely from the offices of the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice in the Midtown area in Detroit. There was a special broadcast covering the visit of Sarah Flounders, the co-director of the International Action Center, who was in town last week to speak at a large meeting on the situation involving imperialist intervention in the Middle Eastern state of Syria. Also speaking on that program was yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, the host of the Pan-Africa Journal and the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. The meeting was chaired by labor historian Martha Gravatt. This program is available via podcast. All you have to do is go to the Fight for Truth radio network and go to that site, and you can download and listen to the June 30th, 2012 edition of the Pan-African Journal, a special information-packed program on the situation in Syria. And we'd just like to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And this week's Pan-African Journal, we're going to begin with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And the leading stories in the Pan-African Newswire for this week include: the professional tennis champion Serena Williams has won her fifth title at Wimbledon in London. Williams is the first woman in her 30s to win the title since Martina Navratilova won in 1990. The United States imposed sanctions on six leading officials in the government of the Horn of Africa nation of Eritrea. The Eritrean government officials are accused of supporting anti-U.S. resistance forces in Somalia. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has threatened China and Russia at a meeting in Paris, which was dubbed the Friends of Syria. The Russian and Chinese governments have refused to go along with U.S. efforts to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And finally, the new Egyptian president, Dr. Mohamed Morsi, has pledged to investigate the circumstances surrounding the deaths of protesters in the Egyptian uprising of 2011. Morsi, representing the Freedom and Justice Party, which is allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, was just sworn in recently in the North African state of Egypt. Serena Williams won her fifth Wimbledon title and 14th major championship by beating Agnieszka Radwańska of Poland 6-1, 5-7, and 6-2 today, Saturday, July 7, 2012. The 30-year-old American had little trouble at the start on center court, using her hard serve and powerful ground strokes to win the first five games and run Radwańska all over the grass. Radwańska, who was playing in her first Grand Slam final, has been ill with a respiratory problem, making it difficult for her to speak. in the second set and already down a break. The third seeded pole was coughing and blowing her nose during a changeover. But she broke Williams in the next game to even the score at 4-4 and then broke again to win the second set. Williams responded in the third set, breaking twice and serving out to win another major title. After hitting a backhand winner on match point, she fell onto her back to the grass. She then rose with a grin as Big Sister Venus, another five-time Wimbledon champion, smiled and applauded, along with the rest of the crowd. After shaking hands with Radwanska, Williams climbed into the box where her family was seated. She hugged her father, Venus, and their mother, as well as others. The match was played with the center court roof open, and it was delayed by rain for a short time after the first set. Later today, Serena and Venus will play in the doubles final. A little more than a month ago, many started writing Williams off for good. She lost in the first round of this year's French Open, the first time she had ever exited a Grand Slam tournament that early. At Wimbledon, she looked every bit a champion again. She broke her own tournament record for aces in a match with 23 against Zheng Ji in the third round. Less than a week later, she eclipsed that mark with 24 against Victoria Azarenka in the semifinals. Today, she finished with 17 aces and a record 102 for the tournament. It was Williams' first Grand Slam title since she won at the All England Club just 2 years ago. But she has had to overcome some of the off-the-court health issues to get back to the top. Shortly after winning at Wimbledon in 2010, Williams cut her feet on glass at a restaurant, leading to a series of health problems, including being hospitalized for blood clots in her lungs. Williams is the first woman in her 30s to win a Wimbledon title since Martina Navratilova, who won at the All England Club in 1990 when she was just 33 years old. Williams is 30 years old. In the men's final, also tomorrow, six-time Wimbledon champion Roger Federer will face British hope Andy Murray. The fourth-seeded Murray is trying to become the first British man to win the title at the All England Club since Fred Perry in 1936. The Obama administration is sanctioning six people, including Eritrea's external intelligence chief and a senior Eritrean military officer, for their roles in allegedly supporting the Somali group resistance organization Al-Shabaab. The Treasury Department announced these sanctions on Thursday, July 5th, under an executive order that allows the administration to impose punitive measures on individuals who threaten peace, security, and stability. That's according to the United States. In Somalia. The sanctions freeze any assets the men may have in the United States and block Americans from doing business with them. The six are accused of providing financial and logistical support to Al-Shabaab, an armed Islamist resistance organization, which is blamed for numerous attacks against the U.S.-backed African Union peacekeepers in Somalia, as well as attacks in Uganda and Kenya. Quote, the United States is determined to target those who are responsible for the ongoing bloodshed and instability in Somalia, unquote. That's according to Adam Zubin, the director of the Treasury Office's Foreign Assets Controls, which administers the sanctions. The two Eritreans hit by the sanctions are Colonel Tewolde Haptay Nagash, the country's external intelligence chief, and the alleged architect of Eritrea's relationship with the Islamic resistance organization Al-Shabaab, and Colonel Taime Abraham Gatone, who is said to be involved with organizing armed opposition to the Somali government. Eritrea has long been accused of fomenting violence in Somalia, in part to keep its arch rival Ethiopia, which shares a long border with Somalia, concerned about unrest there. However, the Eritrean government has long denied any involvement in the internal affairs of Somalia. The sanction also applied to a Sudanese man accused of recruiting foreign fighters for the Al-Shabaab resistance organization and three Kenyans, including a clerk, who are said to have raised money and arms for the Al-Shabaab Resistance Organization, the cleric, Abu Robo Muhammad, is accused of raising funds for Al-Shabaab and helping recruits get to Somalia to join the group. The other two Kenyans, Omar Awad Omar and Abu Bakr Sharif Ahmed, are both in prison. Omar is awaiting trial in Uganda for his alleged involvement in a July 2010 attack on restaurants showing World Cup football matches in Kampala that killed 74 people. Ahmed was arrested in Kenya in 2010 on suspicion of involvement in the bombing of a bus terminal in the capital city of Kenya, Nairobi. And Hillary Clinton has leveled threats against the nations of Russia and China at a so-called Friends of Syria meeting that took place in Paris on yesterday, July 6, 2012. In response to this, German analyst and psychologist Christoph Lehmann wrote yesterday in the NSNBC website that, quote, last Friday's delegates of good and well 100 Arab, Western, and mainly Western allied nations met in Paris under the umbrella of the, quote, Friends of Syria, unquote. As already pointed out in a previous article about the previous meeting of the group, one is tempted to ask the question, quote, with such good friends, who needs any enemies, unquote. The mod goes on to say that the group of friends have been very active in their friendly activities since the meeting in February of 2012. Thus, the terrorist activities, including kidnappings, bombings of civilian infrastructure, the bombing of radio stations, the murder of journalists, have increased. Christoph Lehmann goes on to point out that with their friendly help, the Friends of Syria have succeeded at beefing up the NATO-GCC-led mercenary army in Syria to such a degree that it could commit the friendly act of mass murder in Al-Hula, not to speak about the daily massacres that are taking place in their befriended Syria, which are paid and financed by them. The vultures, sorry, I mean friends, are so kind-hearted that they are already establishing a bureau in Berlin, which is sponsored by Germany and the United Arab Emirates, according to Christoph Lehmann. Lehmann goes on, naturally, a real friend will make sure that he can earn a little on rebuilding the country for which destruction he has been investing on so much. The details about the establishment of the Friends of Syria office in Berlin were described in the previous article. Everything could look rather positive for the group of friends, was it not for the fact that they were badly defeated by Russia and China on the diplomatic front. The Western and Arab corporate and state-sponsored media are keeping populations in la-la land. Not a word about the fact that Syria has held fair elections has reached the public. They have succeeded in hiding the fact that Syria already has an all-inclusive new government with members of the new parties holding key ministry positions. The propaganda machine works flawless. The flow of weapons that kills thousands of Syrian civilians and military personnel in, quote, friendly fire incidents, unquote, is working perfectly. There are plenty of terrorist brigades from Al-Qaeda's LIFG and the Omar Brigade from the Muslim Brotherhood and others who are fighting the, quote, holy NATO war of imperialism and moral colonialism, unquote. Now, one of the really great propaganda victories is that both Arab and Westerners were made to believe that the crackpot dictators from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar are interested in exporting, quote, democracy and human rights, unquote. What a joke, says Christoph Lehmann. So everything would be a land of milk and honey was it not for those bad kids, Russia and China, who succeeded in blocking for another full-scale kinetic humanitarian mass homicide, Libya style. Quote, no military intervention in Syria, no foreign interference, no solution that is dictated from abroad is acceptable, unquote, was a loud and clear message from the uncivilized, human rights violating, warmongering, tyrant supporting, maniacal countries of Russia and China. Peaceful and kind-hearted human beings like Clinton and Obama and all the other real friends of Syria are naturally appalled and outraged by such bad behavior. Consequently, Hillary Clinton stated at the Friends of Syria meeting in Paris that Russia and China, quote, will pay a price, unquote. Right, Hillary, give it to them. The question is, how can the friends of Syria really punish Russia and China for their bad behavior? To make the question more easily understandable, quote, what can they possibly do to make things worse than they already are, unquote? What else, short of overt military aggression against Russia and China, is there left? More troops to the Philippines and Thailand to threaten Chinese trade? Already done. Drag Russia into a long protracted war in the Middle East, Afghanistan, USSR style? That, of course, an option. Manufacture another confrontation in Ossetia? Not unlikely, since rambling Rumi Rumsfeld has just been on a visit to Georgia. Riots in Tibet? IT's always possible to play the Dalai Lama card. Color revolution in Belarusian cities? Already tried. But maybe a second attempt will be more successful. More executed Iranian nuclear scientists, right? The Mossad boys are good at that kind of friendship. Some millions funneled to subversive elements in Russia and China. Already done, and it did not work with Putin at the helm. But there are plenty of options. Increased pressure against Chinese interests in Africa, rare earth metals? No, that's dumb, because the U.S. needs the products that are made in China. The U.S. NATO military capability is overstretched already. The economy is in shambles, and resources are where. But then again, who said that no one has to be particularly intelligent in order to become a, quote, friend of Syria, unquote, according to Christoph Lehmann? Lehmann concludes, it's with the friends of Syria as it is with the Hell's Angels. You qualify if you have the right criminal record and blood on your hands. And that was a commentary by German psychologist and political analyst Christoph Lehmann from the website NSNBC. And the new Egyptian president, Dr. Mohamed Morsi, has appointed a committee to investigate the killing of protesters during and after the uprising early last year during 2011 in what appeared to be a strong challenge to the authority of Egyptian's powerful security services. Dr. Morsi's decree, which was issued late Thursday, July the 5th, and was his 10th in his first week in office, created a 16-member panel to investigate the killing and wounding of peaceful protesters. It also ordered state institutions to cooperate with the committee's work. Dr. Morsi promised during his campaign to address the revolt's most painful legacy, the killing of more than 800 protesters during the uprising that led to the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak in February of 2011, and the killing of dozens of others during the transitional period that followed. The families of the victims have been angered by the lack of accountability because dozens of police officers have been acquitted after trials for the killings. The time frame for the committee's work from the start of the revolt in January of 2011 until the end of last month seemed to represent an attempt by Dr. Morsi to challenge the generals who rule Egypt during the transition and have retained broad powers for the military despite the election of a civilian leader. Mr. Morsi's committee, in theory, has the power to investigate killings that have been attributed to the military, and that occurred during protests held months after Mr. Mubarak stepped down. Quote, this is a change to start addressing the problems behind the uprising, unquote. That's according to Heba Murayev, the Egyptian director for Human Rights Watch, referring to longstanding complaints about police brutality that galvanized the protests. Quote, it's a chance to finally start addressing with impunity, which remained unbroken by the uprising, unquote. Though the committee appears to have been given broad powers to investigate the violence, it is not clear that Mr. Morsi will be able to carry out its recommendations, which are supposed to be delivered to him within 2 months. Of the more than 150 police officers who have been referred to trial by prosecutors since March 2011, only two are serving prison sentences, according to Human Rights Watch, which is tracking the cases. Most of the other cases have resulted in acquittals or are still pending, the group said. Mr. Mubarak and his former Interior Minister, Habib El-Adli, were convicted last month as accessories to murder, but human rights advocates worry that those convictions will be overturned on appeal. Last month, Mr. Mubarak was allowed to leave prison and was sent to a military hospital after an injury caused by slipping in the bathroom, according to his lawyer. Holding the military to account will be even harder. Civilian judges in Egypt can call soldiers as witnesses, but only military courts can try them, Mrs. Moraev has said. The new committee's members, including judges, doctors, senior security officials, and a prosecutor, members of victims' families are to be included as observers. Its mandate includes investigating not only the violence against protesters, but also the conduct of government officials during the previous investigations in order to, quote, clarify how cooperative they were to the judicial authorities, unquote, according to the text of the decree. And inside the United States, the high unemployment rate could impact the reelection bid of the current president, Barack Obama. Newly released data on the U.S. job report indicate that the Obama administration has failed to meet job creation goals in June, leaving the unemployment rate unchanged. According to the U.S. Labor Department, Obama administration officials only managed to create 80,000 jobs, 20,000 less than what was set by the Federal Reserve for a stable job market inside the United States. Overlooking his government's failure to meet the goal by 20,000, Obama described the rise in employment as, quote, a step in the right direction, unquote. Experts expect that the newly released data could mount pressure on the Federal Reserve to encourage it to do more to boost the sluggish economy. The report also indicates that Obama has failed to change the country's unemployment rate, leaving it unchanged at 8.2%. However, the unofficial reports put the real jobless rate of the United States much higher than what the official figures suggest. Release of the critical and gloomy data only 3 months ahead of the November presidential elections could negatively affect the Obama administration's chances to get reelected as the U.S. president for a second term. Shortly after the data was released, U.S. shares fell sharply as the future of the U.S. dem economy seems to remain uncertain. The United States has been experiencing sluggish economic growth since the global financial crisis affected the country about 5 years ago. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a regular basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and right now you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Pan-African Journal, an audio news magazine, brings you the most pressing and burning issues inside the African continent, the diaspora, as well as the international community as a whole. The Pan-African Journal is being broadcast today live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. The Kenyan Defense Forces have officially joined the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, in a bid to secure peace and stability in the neighboring war-ravaged country of Somalia. This is according to a report issued by Press TV on yesterday, Friday, July 6, 2012. The announcement was made during a ceremony held in the capital city of Nairobi on yesterday. The special representative of the chairperson of the African Union Commission for Somalia, Ambassador Boubacar Gusau Diarra, and Lieutenant General Andrew Guti, attended the ceremony on behalf of the Western-backed African Union mission to Somalia. Quote, we are proud to welcome our brothers and sisters from Kenya in this African effort to help the people of Somalia, unquote, Diarra said in a press release. Quote, a major goal of the African Union is to encourage the collective defense, security, and stability of its members, unquote, he added. Lauding the neighboring state of Kenya for its effort to restore peace in Somalia, Diarra further noted that, quote, the integration of Kenyan forces into AMISOM will provide a boost to the efforts to secure the Somalia peace process and help create the security conditions to enable much-needed humanitarian assistance to be delivered to the needy population, unquote. Now, integrating 46 64 King and personnel into Amazon. The move brings the Amazon force strength to slightly over 17,000 troops. The U.S.-backed transitional federal government in Somalia has not had a functioning government, and they are taking the place of the political vacuum that has existed now for some 21 years. This resulted in the overthrow of the former Western-backed president, Mohamed Siad Barre. Now, the weak Western-backed government in Mogadishu has been battling the Al-Shabaab Islamist Resistance Organization for the past 5 years and is propped up, in fact, by a strong AU force backed up by the U.S.-trained and financed governments of Uganda, Burundi, and neighboring Djibouti, where an AFRICOM base is located. Somalia is one of the countries generating the highest number of refugees and internally displaced persons in the entire world. In the Central African nation of Congo, thousands of Congolese refugees have crossed into neighboring Uganda and East Africa, fleeing from firefights between the government troops and the March 23rd movement, the M23 rebels. The Ugandan Red Cross Society said in a statement that nearly 4,500 refugees crossed into Uganda following the capture of the border town of Bunagana in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. This was reported by the Xinhua news agency on yesterday, July 6, 2012. Quote, yesterday, Thursday, July the 5th, Ugandan Red Cross Society volunteers registered 1,765 refugees, new arrivals in Nyakabande, transferred by the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, from the border, unquote, the statement said. The statement added that 2,235 more refugees from Bunagana were likely to be transferred to Nyakabande Transfer Center, where 8,353 refugees are already living. The rebels, known as the March 23rd Movement, defected from the Congolese army just this last past April in protest over alleged mistreatment in the armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the FARDC. They had been integrated into the Congolese army under a peace deal signed in 2009. The mutiny is being led by General Bosco Ntaganda, who was wanted by the International Criminal Court on a charge of recruiting child soldiers. More than 10,000 Congolese citizens have fled to Rwanda and Uganda since early May to escape the fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, Congo has faced numerous problems over the past decades, such as the grinding poverty, crumbling infrastructure, and a war in the east of a country that has dragged on for over a decade and left over 5.5 million people dead. And finally, inside the United States, the killer of an African-American youth has been released on $1 million bail. George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed the unarmed African-American teenager Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, has been released from prison. Zimmerman left the Seminole County Jail yesterday, July 6, 2012, a day after Circuit Judge Kenneth Lester approved a bail of $1 million. However, Zimmerman is required to stay in Seminole County and must be electronically monitored. Quote, he's very happy to be out, unquote. That's according to Don West, one of Zimmerman's attorneys. He told this to the media outside the jail. Quote, certainly it's been a sobering experience spending the last month in jail in that kind of environment, unquote. Now, in April, Zimmerman was released on $150,000 bail, but the judge revoked it in June and sent him back to jail, citing the fact that both Zimmerman and his wife misled the court about their finances, especially about the money raised from a website soliciting cash for Zimmerman's defense. Now, on June 12th, Zimmerman's wife, Sheila Zimmerman, was arrested and charged with perjury. On the same day, Trayvon Martin's parents denounced the way the state controversial, quote, stand your ground, unquote, law can be used to protect aggressors and call for the law to be amended. Martin's family is asking the state of Florida to ratify the, quote, Trayvon Martin, unquote, amendment to the, quote, Stand Your Ground, unquote, law, which would state that, quote, you can't pursue or start a fight and use the law, unquote, Benjamin Crump, the attorney for the Martin family, noted. The Stand Your Ground allows people to use deadly force if they feel their life is in danger. Over 300,000 Floridians have signed a petition demanding that the law be repealed. Martin, a 17-year-old African-American teenager, was gunned down by the 28-year-old Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida, on February the 26th. And with that story, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire as part of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And in concluding this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire, we'd like to recap the main stories in the Pan-African Newswire for this week. The professional tennis champion, Serena Williams, has won her fifth title at Wimbledon in London. Williams, the first woman in her 30s to win the title since Martina Navratilova won in 1990. The United States has imposed sanctions on six leading officials, some of whom are from the East African Horn of Africa nation of Eritrea. The Eritrean government officials are accused of supporting anti-U.S. resistance forces in neighboring Somalia. The United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has threatened China and Russia at a meeting in Paris dubbed the Friends of Syria. The Russian and Chinese governments have refused to go along with the United States' efforts to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. And finally, the new Egyptian president, Dr. Mohamed Morsi, has pledged to investigate the circumstances surrounding the deaths of protesters in Egypt. Morsi is representing the Freedom and Justice Party, which is allied with the Muslim Brotherhood. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire as part of the Pan-African Journal. As we mentioned before, the Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and today, July 7th, 2012, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit, and we'd like to remind our listeners that this program can be listened to again and can be forwarded and can be shared by merely logging on to the Fight for Truth Radio Network. In the immediate aftermath of this broadcast, it will be podcast for your utilization. And right now, we'd like to take another brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
This week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and today we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. We'd like to remind our listeners once again that this program will be available via podcast in the immediate aftermath of its conclusion, and you can share this program with other listeners throughout the length and breadth of the planet. This week we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit, and of course last week we had a special broadcast that dealt with the current situation that is going on right now vis-a-vis Syria. And we are, of course, following very closely the situation in Syria. It is a very fluid and developing situation where, in fact, the U.S. government, NATO, are attempting to foment the struggle against the people of Syria. And, of course, this is a very, very important development, We've been following it. Just this last past week, we had the co-director of the International Action Center was here in the city of Detroit, and that program was covered live by the Pan-African Journal. And, of course, this has been a very, very important development, and we have been following these developments very, very closely. And right now, we're going to share with you some very important information from Prison Radio involving Mumia Abu-Jamal and his views on the current situation involving the murder of Trayvon Martin.
Daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, April 16th, 2012, and I'm your host, Pranali Gohatkar. California faculty decide whether or not to strike over stagnant wages and fee hikes. As Catholic church leaders defund organizations over politics, progressive Catholics step up, and an update on the ongoing revolutions in Syria and Bahrain. That's a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising, a team of 30. They're monitoring a 5-day ceasefire in Syria today.
And, of course, this is the Pan-African Journal, and we wanted to, first of all, point out that we're moving towards some commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal, and what we had there was excerpts from Uprising Radio. But what we're looking for is commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he, of course, is very much on top of what is going on outside the prison walls where he's being held at Mahoney Prison in the state of Pennsylvania. And Mumia Abu-Jamal is no longer on death row. He's in general population. But the struggle for his freedom continues. The supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are by no means satisfied with the ruling of the federal courts saying that he should be sentenced to life in prison. Of course, his supporters feel that he is innocent and he should be released from the prison. And, of course, this is something that millions share throughout the length and breadth of the world. And, of course, we are here today on the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And right now, we're going to hear some excerpts from various commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Sekou Onyeka, warrior, Black Panther, Black Liberation Soldier, Sekou Odinga, warrior, Black Panther, Black Liberation Soldier, named after African warriors and statesmen. Sekou Touré, the Marxist first president of an independent Guinea. And Odinga Odinga, the Kenyan freedom fighter for Mau Mau. Sekou Odinga, prisoner of the white empire. Sekou Odinga, happy birthday. We know what it means to have a birthday in a cage, but every birthday is a kind of victory. And congrats on your marriage. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that was a birthday greeting to Sekou Odinga, who is incarcerated in life in prison right now. He is, of course, one of the great warriors of the African-American liberation struggle. And right now, we're going to hear a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal on the case of Trayvon Martin.
For a brief moment in time, the name and fate of Trayvon Martin broke through the daily media fog and touched the lives of tens of thousands of people, motivating them, mobilizing them, and moving them to take direct action against the gross inaction of the state. Youth across Florida walked out of high schools and took the streets of Martin. People in dozens of cities marched, seemingly spontaneously, against the non-action of the state. Why? Because for many of these teenagers, they sensed the unsaid truth. It could have been them. It could have been them. Those kids pushed the state to act. The movement for growing more and more and spreading like kudzu in the southern sun. And this protest against anti-black violence takes place amidst the greatest institutional violence against blacks since the height of the civil rights movement. By that I mean the silent assault of mass incarceration, or what law professor Michelle Alexander Jim Crow, incidentally, the title of her new book. And it matters not that Trayvon's killer wasn't a cop, as is usually the case. He was an informal auxiliary to a system that polices black life and holds their every act under suspicion. No matter what the result of the Trayvon Martin case, I happen to think an acquittal is down the line. The new Jim Crow pecks at black, brown, and poor lives daily, destroying any future they may have once dreamed of having. But what we learned from Trayvon's case is protest works. For without these protests, there would have been no case. That lesson must translate to the vast social injustice of the prison industrial complex. When more black men are in chains today than at the dawn of the Civil War, when slavery was legal, or when the South African system of apartheid was in full swing, protests, mass protests, are the necessity. From a prison nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Trayvon and the war against us. For a brief moment in time, the name and fate of Trayvon Martin broke through the daily media fog and touched the lives of tens of thousands of people, motivating them, mobilizing them, and moving them to take direct action against the gross inaction of the state. Youth across Florida walked out of high schools and took the streets of Martin. People in dozens of cities marched, seemingly spontaneously, against the non-action of the state. Why? Because for many of these teenagers, they sensed the unsaid truth. It could have been them. It could have been them. LeBron's rise. For Miami basketball superstar LeBron James, 2012 is his year. His time out of the wilderness is arrival. A formidable high school basketball phenom, his time as a professional has been one of conflict and chaos, jumping ship from the Cleveland Cavaliers amid wounds, catcalls, and cries of traitor. When he and Chris Bosh left their respective teams, the Cavs and Toronto Raptors, for the Miami Heat, they were assailed by the sports media for daring to decide their own destinies. For athletes are supposed to be told what to do, not make their own decisions. And when the Heat lost the 2011 championship to the Dallas Mavericks, 2-4, the ridicule, the catcalls got even louder. James and Bosh left their former teams after 7 fruitless seasons, hungry for gold. James, Bosh, and Miami's Dwayne Wade, a scoring leader for the NBA as recently as 2009, formed the threesome who would take Miami back to the prom, and they played one of the most thrilling b-ball championships in modern sports history. That's because despite the scoreline, the Oklahoma City Thunder played smart, tight basketball. They turned the tables on Miami enough times to give their coach a coronary, and they wanted to win. But ultimately, there was too much heat for the Thunder to prevail. James, Bosch, Wade, and the Heat team conspired to make it happen. They call him King James, because now he is from a prison nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And you're listening to the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal over the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And as I said before, we're listening to the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is still incarcerated at the SCI Mahoney facility in the state of Pennsylvania. And right now we have another commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal entitled Immigration Nation.
Immigration Nation. It is a tale of the times that America's highest court, the Supreme Court, could rule on the controversial issue of immigration and both sides could claim victory. If ever one wondered if the court was a profoundly political institution, if one could dare question after the Bush v. Gore debacle, Arizona versus United States provides abundant ammunition in the affirmative. For the court, 5-3 struck down 3 of 4 state initiatives, saying the Arizona laws encroached on federal authority. And yet, the court let stand, with qualifications, the 4th most controversial law, the so-called Show Me Your Papers program. Thus, state and county law enforcement personnel can, for the time being, stop anyone suspected of being in violation of a law or statute, and, by the way, inquire into that suspect's immigration status. And who do you think are the usual suspects? Canadians? Irish? Belgians? Seriously? We all know that this law was based on one thing and one thing only, forcing Hispanics out of the sphere of work and hopefully out of Arizona. It's based on fear of a brown state. Nothing else makes sense. Many Americans, especially white Americans, are terrified of the nation's fastest growing minority. They fear that these 50 plus million people will forever transform the nation of their memories. That was the genesis of Arizona's SB 107. It's behind the Show Me Your Papers provision in that act, and that's why the Supremes gave it a pass. Fear, and it ain't over. From a prison nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and we're listening to the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And right now, we have another commentary on the recent passing of Rodney King.
Rodney King, 1965-2012. Mention the name Rodney King, and people react. They might react in different ways, but they react. For almost no one is neutral. His name is evocative because it ties you to one of the biggest urban rebellions in America, the 1991 Los Angeles riots, after the acquittal of a phalanx of cops who beat King mercilessly on videotape. When a predominantly white jury in Simi Valley acquitted them, the streets of L.A. exploded. It was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. Not since the 1960s have we seen riots so large or so destructive. The riots made Rodney King famous or infamous, depending on one's perspective. The image of his battered face asking plaintiffs, "Can we all get along?" have entered the realm of history. A question we have yet to truly answer. Rodney King, 8:46, was found dead early Sunday morning, apparently drowned at the bottom of his pool. For Rodney King, his life is over. From a prison nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And welcome back once again. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and we just heard a series of commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who in fact is still serving time at SCI Mahoney. In general population now, not on death row, but still, people are advocating and organizing to bring about his release, his total exoneration. And just this last past April 24th, there was a Occupy the Justice Department rally in Washington, D.C., and that took place at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. The march took place, and, of course, it continued to other areas of Washington, D.C., and also continued to areas around the White House, and, of course, then there was a occupation at the White House, and with that, it was a very, very important development in terms of the overall movement to bring about the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It was entitled Occupy the Justice Department, and Mumia Abu-Jamal, of course, still is writing, still discussing many of the pressing and burning issues of the day. And that is very important in regard to the overall struggle for the liberation of all political prisoners here inside the United States. And right now, we're going to take another brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Oh,
Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. I'm your host, Abayomi Ezekwe, and we're broadcasting today live, July 7th, 2012, from our studios here in the city of Detroit. 52 years ago, in the Central African nation of Congo, the so-called Congo crisis was in full swing. On June 30th of 1960, a new government was formed under the leadership of Patrice Lumumba, the first and duly elected prime minister of the Congo. Soon afterwards, the immediate destabilization of that Central African nation took place. The former colonial power of Belgium, the United States government, along with the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, along with the United Nations, which was largely functioning under the aegis of U.S. imperialism at the time, collaborated to bring about the destabilization and the consequent undermining of the national independence of the former Belgian Congo. Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, who at that time was the president of the First Republic of Ghana, went to the United Nations in October of 1960 to deliver a major address on the current situation at that time in Congo, which had left the Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba virtually under house arrest inside the capital of Leopoldville. Right now, we're going to hear the speech of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah before the United Nations General Assembly in October 1960.
Distinguished delegates, the great tide of history flows, and as it flows, it carries to the shores of reality the solemn facts of life and man's relations one with another. One cardinal fact of our time is the momentous impact of Africa's awakening upon the modern world. The flowing tide of African nationalism sweeps everything before it and constitutes a challenge to the colonial powers to make a just restitution for the years of injustice and crime committed against our continent. But Africa does not seek vengeance. It is against her very nature to harbor malice. Over 2 million of our people cry out with one voice of tremendous power. And what do they say? We do not ask for death, for our oppressors. We do not pronounce wishes of ill fate for our slave masters. We make an assertion of a just and positive demand. Our voice goes across the oceans and mountains, over the hills and valleys, in the desert places, and through the vast extent of mankind's inhabitations. And it calls out for the freedom of Africa. Africa wants its freedom. Africa must be free. It is a simple call, but it's also a signal, lighting a red warning to those who tend to ignore it. For years and years, Africa has been the footstool of colonialism and imperialism, exploitation and degradation. From the north to the south, from the east to the west, her songs languished in chains of slavery and humiliation, and Africa's exploiters and self-appointed controllers of her destiny stood across the land with incredible inhumanity, without mercy, without shame, and without honor. But these days are gone, and gone forever. And now I, an African, stand before this august assembly of the United Nations and speak with the voice of peace and freedom, proclaiming to the world the dawn of a new era. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, I wish to thank the General Assembly sincerely for this opportunity of addressing you. Let me say here and now that our tribulations and sufferings harden and steal us, making us a battle of incredible courage and fortifying our iron determination. This my shall change. I look upon the United Nations as the only organization that holds out any hope for the future of mankind. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, cast your eyes across Africa. The colonialists and imperialists are still there. In this 20th century of enlightenment, some nations still extol the vain glories of colonialism and imperialism. As long as a single foot of African soil remains under British domination, the world shall know no peace. The United Nations must therefore face up to its responsibilities and ask those who would bury their heads like the proverbial ostrich in their imperialist time to pull their heads up and look at the blazing African sun now traveling across the sky of Africa's redemption. The United Nations must call upon all nations that have colonies in Africa to grant complete independence to the territories still under their control. In my view, possession of colonies is now quite incompatible with membership of the United Nations. This is a new day in Africa, and as I speak now, 13 new African nations have taken their seat this year in this August Assembly as independent sovereign states. The readiness of many people to assume responsibility for governing themselves can be determined only by themselves. I am the government of Ghana, and I'm sure the government and people of independent African states share the joy of welcoming our sister states into the family of the United Nations. There are now 22 of us in this assembly, and there are yet more to come. I would suggest that when the Charter of the United Nations comes to be revised, a permanent seat should be created for Africa on the Security Council in view not only of the growing number of African members of the United Nations, but also of the increasing importance of the African continent in world affairs. This suggestion applies equally to Asia and to the Middle East. Many questions come to my mind at the moment, all seeking to be dealt with at once. Questions concerning the Congo, disarmament, peace, South Africa, Southwest Africa, China, and Algeria. However, I would like to start with the question of the Congo, how to take others in their turn.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. We're listening to the historic speech of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the President of the First Republic of Ghana, delivered before the United Nations General Assembly in October of 1960. We just heard the introduction to this historic speech, and right now we're going to hear Kwame Nkrumah's view of the then current situation in the former Belgian Congo, which, as we had mentioned in the introduction, was at that time facing a tremendous crisis with the intervention of the former colonial power of Belgium, the United States imperialist government of Dwight Eisenhower, the United Nations that was largely under the aegis of the United States political rule, as well as other imperialist and allied imperialist states. Right now we're going to hear the next section of this historic speech of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah before the United Nations in October of 1960, where he discusses his views on developments in Congo.
Congo, as we all know, has been a Belgian colony for nearly a century. In all those years, Belgium applied a system of calculated political castration in the hope that it would be completely impossible for African nationalists to fight for their emancipation. to this million person. I want to be surprised of everyone outside the African continent. This dreaded nationalism appears. And with a licensed patient time of time, secure the independence of the Congo. The policy of political frustration pursued by the Belgian colonial regime created a situation in which the Belgian administration was unable to continue, while at the same time, local police has been trained to take over and run the state. The struggle for independence in the Congo is the shortest so far recorded, and the Belgians were so overtaken by events that they pulled out, but fully expected to return in one way or another. The high positions in this, in the army, the police, and the public services have been the exclusive reserves of the Belgians. No African could hope to rise to the lowest commission rank in the army. The whole of the force public was subject to extremely high discipline and had a very low grace of faith. This situation made it impossible to build up the kind of indigenous personnel to man the services. As soon as an African became Minister of Defense, the incongruous position of the African in the force public became evident. Great discontent resulted. Even so, the situation might not have erupted had the Belgian commander of the force public adopted a realistic attitude towards the men and made any attempt to redress the legitimate grievances of the Congolese soldiers. Even a promise of future reform might have done some good. On the contrary, emphatic statements were indiscreetly made by Belgian officers that nothing had changed and that life would go on much the same way as before independence. In short, the soldiers were told that independence was a sham and that Belgium still wielded the big stick. This produced the mutiny. When the mutiny occurred, large numbers of Belgians began to leave the country. The President of the Republic, Mr. Kasekubu, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Lumumba, went to Matadi in order to appeal to the Belgians to remain. But instead, they were all taken on board ships on the advice of the Belgian consul, while the town was machine gunned from the air by the Belgian military aircraft and shelled from the sea. Despite the fact that there were no Belgian civilians whatsoever to protect, Belgian troops entered the town and shot in cold blood a number of unarmed police and civilians. It was following upon this incident that acts of organized violence by members of the force public began to occur. These incidents, in their turn, provided a location for Belgian military intervention. Meanwhile, ostensibly on grounds of safeguarding the lives of the Belgians in the province, Belgian troops entered Katanga in considerable numbers and enabled the chairman of the Provisional Council, Moses Tshombe, to set himself up as the head of a so-called independent state. The whole of the administration of this so-called state was in Belgian hands, and it was supported and maintained openly by Belgian troops. The situation was thus one of extreme danger. The Belgian army was desperately occupying the Congo, pleading as their excuse circumstances which were fundamentally all of Belgium's own making. The Congo government called for aid. Congo asked Ghana for help, and also wisely called in the United Nations. From this point, distinguished delegates, you are more than conversant with the story, and there is no need for me to dwell in detail on the facts. It's only necessary to say that something has happened in the Congo, which has justified my constant warning to the African countries to be on their guard against what I call play and tell sovereignty or fake independence by the metropolitan power, with the concealed intention of making the liberated country a client state and controlling it effectively by means other than political ones. What has happened in the Congo has more than justified my continuous outcry against the threat of balkanization in Africa and more than justified my daily condemnation of new colonialism, the process of handing independence over to the African people with one hand, only to take it away with the other hand. The Congo question is a test case for Africa. What is happening in the Congo today may happen in any other part of Africa tomorrow. And what the United Nations does today must set a precedent or a pattern for what it will have to do tomorrow. The United Nations will be judged by the success or failure of this handling of this Congo situation. Certain propositions seem to me to be self-evident. The first of these is that the United Nations need not go to the assistance of any country which invites this intervention, but that once it has done so, it owes an obligation to the government and people of that country not to intervene in such a way as to prevent the legitimate government which invited it to enter the country from fulfilling its mandate. In other words, it is impossible for the United Nations at one at the same time to preserve law and order and to be neutral between the legal authorities and the lawbreakers. It is unfortunately exactly this which the United Nations has attempted to do in the case of the Congo, and which, in the cause of all, is the cause of all the present difficulties and disagreements. My second proposition is that in any sovereign state, there can be only one national army. If a soldier disobeys the superior officer and owes and uses his arms to murder and to loot, he's a mutineer. There is, however, no difference between his position and that of a colonel who disregards the authority which appointed him and uses the troops under his own command for his own purposes. The United Nations, in enforcing law and order, must deal equally sternly with either of these two types of mutineers. The failure, or rather this failure, by the United Nations is to distinguish between legal and illegal authorities had led to the most ridiculous results, embarrassing both the Ghanaian forces who were called upon to carry them out and to the United Nations itself, which was exhibited in a ridiculous light. For instance, the very troops which Ghana sent to help the legitimate Lumumba government at the request of Lumumba were employed by the United Nations in preventing Lumumba, the legitimate prime minister of the legal government of the Congo Republic, from performing the most obvious part of his duties, for instance, using his own radio station. Distinguished delegates, these difficulties are, in a sense, growing pains of the United Nations. And it would be entirely wrong to blame either the Security Council or any senior official of the United Nations for what has taken place. However, a new approach is clearly required. I believe that it is not difficult to devise methods by which the issue can be appropriately dealt with. Let us get down to realities. The United Nations were invited to enter the Congo in a message from the head of state, Mr. Kasavubu, and from the Prime Minister, Mr. Lumumba. Both these gentlemen were appointed to their respective offices in accordance with the Constitution and in accordance with the will of the Congolese people expressed through elections. Here then is the legal government which should be supported and aligned with the United Nations to throw its weight and authority. I am sure that the independent African state would agree with me that the problem in the Congo is an acute African problem which can be solved by Africans only. I have, on more than one occasion, suggested that the United Nations should delegate its functions in the Congo to the independent African states, especially those African states whose contribution in men and materials make the United Nations effort in the Congo possible. The forces of these African states should be under a united African command with responsibility to the Security Council in accordance with the first resolution of the Security Council under which the United Nations troops entered the Congo Republic. I suggest that the General Assembly should make it absolutely clear that the United Nations constituents in the Congo Republic have an overriding responsibility to preserve law and order, which can only be done by supporting, safeguarding, and maintaining the legal and existing parliamentary framework of the state. In order to prevent illegal actions of all sorts, it is necessary that, in cooperation with the legitimate government of the Republic, the National Army should be retrained, regrouped, and reorganized so that there is finally established one army responsible only to the central government. These proposals, if accepted, will result in the withdrawal of all non-African troops from the Congo and make it easy to identify and eliminate the Belgian troops who have been infiltrated into the territory in defiance of the Security Council resolution. In this connection, one must mention Katanga, which brings to mind the regrettable and most vicious attempt being made by vested interests to bolster up a puppet regime there using poor Moise Tshombe against his own government to break up the Congo Republic by secessionist activities. I'm sure, Mr. President and distinguished delegates, that no African state would lend support to any secessionist move in the Congo. The Congo is the heart of Africa, and we shall do our utmost to prevent any injuries being inflicted upon it by imperialist and colonial regimes. The Congo, including Katanga and Kasa, is one and indivisible. Any other approach is mere wishful thinking, for not all the mineral wealth in that interior part of the Congo can create Katanga as a separate state. The crisis in the Congo must be arrested now before it sparks off another world conflagration. The sun powers do not appear to realize the gravity of the situation and are playing with fire by attempting to use the United Nations as a group for their own ends. I personally and my government have done everything possible to assist and advise the leaders of the Congo to resolve their differences and place their countries and Africa's interests first. Both of them, President Kasavubu and the Prime Minister Lumumba, speak the same language of peace and unity. Both of them are anxious to see stability achieved in their country. Both of them agree to reconciliation. What then prevents them from coming together? What has led to the fake Mobutu episode? I can assure the civil delegates that, but for the interest of the colonialists, a document of reconciliation which has been drafted in the presence of my ambassador in Lupita and approved by both Mr. Lukasebubu and Mr. Lumumba could have been signed by them. In today's history, stark and naked, one desperately at work to prevent this being signed. The policy of divide and rule is still being practiced energetically by the opponents of African independence and unity. Mr. President and distinguished delegates, it's quite clear that a desperate attempt is being made to create confusion in the Congo, extend the Cold War to Africa, and involve Africa in the suicidal patterns of foreign powers. The United Nations must not allow this to happen. We, for our part, will not allow this to happen. That is why we are anxious that the United Nations have to reach a point why intervention on the side of the legitimate government of the Congo appears to be the obvious and only answer to this crisis should add boldly to the vision of the independent African states. Let these African states act under the canopy of the United Nations and produce the exact result. In these particular circumstances, the Congo crisis should be handed over to the independent African states for solution. I'm sure that left to them, an effective solution can be found. It is negative to believe and hesitate until the situation becomes irredeemable and develops into another Korea. I would go further and suggest that all financial aid or technical assistance to the Congo Republic should be arranged only with the legitimate government of the Congo Republic, channeled through the United Nations and guaranteed and supervised by a committee of the independent African states appointed by the Security Council, who should be accountable to the United Nations. Having dwelt at length on the Congo situation, which is only natural in view of its gravity, I now wish Mr. President and distinguished delegates to turn to other matters. But before I do so, it is pertinent here to sound a strong note of warning, namely, that if some people are now thinking in terms of prestige over the Congo to carry out their potential of resources and wealth, let those people forever describe that idea, for any such suggestion to be resisted. There can be no question of prestige in the Congo. The Congo is independent and sovereign. The colonialists and imperialists must remember this fact and remember it for all time.
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. Right now we're reviewing a speech delivered by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of the Republic of Ghana, on October 25th of 1960 before the United Nations General Assembly. We just heard the section on the so-called Congo crisis of 1960, which Ghana was very much a part of. Right now, in this segment of the speech, Dr. Nkrumah will discuss the then current situation in Southern Africa.
I would now like, if I may, turn to the question of Southwest Africa. Although opinions delivered by the International Court so that South Africa, Southwest Africa, is strictly not a test territory, there can be no doubt whatever that the United Nations, as a successor of the League of Nations, has a particular responsibility towards Southwest Africa. I consider also that Ghana has a particular responsibility in regard to what is taking place in Southwest Africa. The justification for the private journey of this colony and of testing its government in Southwest Africa was based upon the United Kingdom document entitled The Native Tribes in Southwest Africa and Their Treatment by Germany. Explain the attitude of Imperial Germany towards Africans. This United Kingdom publication exposed the act of brutal suppression perpetrated against the Africans of this territory by the Germans. In fact, however, the policy laid down by the old German Imperial Colonial Office exactly produces the policy now being pursued in Southwest Africa by the Union of South Africa. In his 1957 report to the Committee on Southwest Africa, the Secretary General has quoted a speech by a senator nominated by the Union government to represent Southwest Africa in the Union States. This senator, Dr. Beda, actually delivered a long and detailed speech to the Senate pointed out that in every respect, the Union government was merely carrying on the traditional method for ruling Africans defined by the Imperial Germany and imposed in Southwest Africa by Dr. Gary, the father of the notorious fascist Herman Boris. The United Kingdom government, which made the case against Germany in regard to Southwest Africa, was, in reality, a Commonwealth document. At the Peace Treaty of Versailles, the Commonwealth was collectively represented by the United Kingdom, which acted in the name of and on behalf of the then British Empire. What therefore was done at Versailles was done in the name not only of the United Kingdom. In a report made to the General Assembly last year by the Committee on Southwest Africa and approved by the General Assembly, the committee stated that the policy of apartheid as practiced in Southwest Africa is a flagrant violation of the sacred trust which commits the mandate and the charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. For 13 years now, the Union of South Africa has consistently disregarded the request of the United Nations in regard to Southwest Africa. The Union imposes the most harsh and decreed regime upon the inhabitants, which is not in any way in accord with the provisions of the mandate. There is a duty on the United Nations to enforce the mandate, and the United Nations must not fail in its duty. In this duty. Mr. President, in this connection, I wish to make the following positive proposal. The Union of South Africa should be asked to surrender the mandate to the United Nations, and a committee of all the independent African states should be set up to administer the territory on behalf of the United Nations. If the Union of South Africa is unable to agree to this, then the next General Assembly of the United Nations should take steps to terminate the mandate, make the territory a transition area, and appoint independent African states to undertake the transition. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, I now turn to the Union of South Africa itself. The Union government, against all moral considerations against and against every concept of human dignity, self-respect and decency, has established a policy of racial discrimination and persecution, which in its essential inhumanity surpasses even the brutality of the Nazis against the Jews. The interest of humanity compels every nation to take steps against such inhuman policy and to act in concert to eliminate it from the world. To this end, Ghana has taken the following action. We have asked on the 1st of August this year called a total boycott of South African goods, close all Ghanaian ports, sea as well as air, the South African shipping and aircraft, except in case of distress, and has required that African citizens entered Ghana to have in their possession travel documents issued by the Ghana government or passports with valid Canadian transit visas. This action is in implementation of the unanimous resolution adopted by the independent African states in Addis Ababa last June. Indeed, the hollow social places of apartheid and the grievous practical harm it causes can be judged by the gruesome massacre of defenseless men and women and children at Sabreville in March this year by the Union Police. The untenable claims of the minority in South Africa is steadily building a wall of intense hate, which will result in the most violent and incredible consequences in the future, unless this minority abandons the negligent racial policy which it pursues.
And we're listening to the historic speech by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the president of the First Republic of Ghana, before the United Nations General Assembly on October 25th of 1960. He just discussed the current situation in the then Southwest Africa, which later became Namibia, as well as the Union of South Africa, which later became the Republic of South Africa. Right now, Dr. Nkrumah will discuss the then situation in the Portuguese colonies in Africa.
We are now turn with your permission, Mr. President, to the most regrettable question of the war in Algeria. For the past 6 years or more, this war has remained a big problem for us all. For more than 6 years, the sons of Algeria have been stained red with blood. And French and Algerian youth in their thousands have rushed to their death. The power of French youth is being wasted in an attempt to maintain an impossible fiction that Algeria is part of France. But at the same time, the youth of Algeria are forced to give their lives in a conflict which will be settled tomorrow by the application of the principles of the United Nations. This utter waste of the flower of youth of France and Algeria as a result of a senseless war must now stop. And the responsibility for stopping it should rest squarely on the United Nations. No argument about it being an internal problem of France can solve the issue. For in fact, the subject of the shooting war can never be the internal problem of any power, since it's back in the wrong direction by anyone who spreads the fire and cause world conflagration. France cannot win a military victory in Algeria. If he hopes to do so, then his hopes are false and unrelated to the realities of the situation. Indeed, any person who thinks that France can win a military victory in Algeria lives in a world of utter illusion. And the time and time will prove that I'm right. The only way out of this tragic impasse is the way of negotiation. There was indeed a bright ray of hope a year ago when the President of France made his declaration as such the principles of the right of determination of the Algerian people. It is sad that the purpose of this declaration was later treated with contempt by France herself, thereby defeating this fine gesture of goodwill for the solution of the Algerian problem. I feel strongly that whatever has happened in Algeria, France and the Algerian nationalist government can still sit face to face on equal terms at the negotiating table and produce workable results which will bring peace to both sides and put an end to this catastrophe. But whatever angle you view this problem, you cannot escape from the fact that Algeria is African and will always remain so, in the same way that France is French. No accident of history, such as has occurred in Algeria, can ever succeed in turning an inch of African soil into an extension of any other continent. Colonialism and imperialism cannot change this basic geographical fact. If colonialism and imperialism attempt to do this, we shall have nothing but the strife and confusion that we are witnessing in the world today. Let France and the other colonial powers take this fact and be guided by it accordingly. The problem of Africa looks as a whole, it's a wide and diversified one. But its true solution lies in the application of one principle, namely the right of a people to rule themselves. No compromise can affect this cardinal and fundamental principle. And the idea that men, that when a handful of settlers acquire a living space from our continent, the indigenous must lose this right, is not only a serious tragedy of justice, but also a woeful contradiction of the very dictates of history. out of a total African population of over 230 million people, some 3% are of non-African origin. Mr. President and distinguished delegates, to suppose that such a small minority could in any other continent produce acute political difficulties would be unthinkable. Yet, such is the subconscious feeling of certain European settlers in Africa that to them, the paramount issue in Africa is not the welfare of the 97%, but rather the entrenchment of the rights of the 3% of the European settlers minorities in Africa. To these minority settlers, the solution seems impossible unless why they decide that justice and justice, I quote in quotation marks, is down to the foreign 3%. Justice, they say, must be down to this group, irrespective of whether it means that injustices continue to be down to the remaining inhabitants. I believe that reasonable solution can be found to the African problem, which will not prejudice the minorities on the continent. No effective solution, however, can be found if political thinking in regard to the solution begins with the rights of the 3% and only consider the rights of the 97% within the framework which are separate from the rest. The world was beginning to lose applies to African problems in the light of the needs of the African people and not only of the needs of minority settlers. Colonialism and imperialism and regionalism are doomed in Africa. And the sooner the colonial powers recognize this fact, the better it will be for them and the world. I now turn to your permission, Mr. President, to the most regrettable president of the war in Algeria. For the past 6 years or more, I have spoken at length on African questions, and I must now turn my attention to other matters. I will accordingly make a few observations on this argument. In my view, we are passing through another scientific and industrial revolution. We should make unnecessary the division of the world into developed and less developed areas. We must therefore avoid economic thinking based upon the conditions of the past. However, we must avoid an attitude of mind which applies in an era of abundance the economic theories worked out to serve an age of scarcity. Fundamentally, the argument in favor of disarmament can be looked at in two ways. First, it is ridiculous to pile up arms which were destroyed the contestants in a future war impartially and equally. Secondly, it is tragic that preoccupation with armaments prevent the big powers from perceiving what are the real forces in the world today. If world population continues to grow, and if inequality between the so-called developed and the underdeveloped countries is allowed to remain in conditions where it is no longer technically and scientifically justified, then however great the armament piled up and international explosion cannot, in my view, be averted. While there exists the means of providing world prosperity, the great American majority of mankind will not agree forever to remain in a position of inferiority. Armaments, therefore, not only threaten the future of mankind, but provide no answer to the major problems of our age. Possibly, the cause of disarmament has suffered because it is looked upon in a negative way. In some countries, at any rate, industrial prosperity is associated with the rearmament and military preparations and the recession with the slowing down of military effort. This is because this family is looked at in a dark way. He should be looked upon as a means for the redeployment of the capital resources and the technical skills now being used for military purposes. What is required at the United Nations is some fundamental thinking and planning about the redeployment of the armament capacity of the countries which disarm. Side by side with technical discussions as to how nuclear weapons can be controlled, there should be considered discussions as to how resources released by the control of these weapons to be used in the service of mankind. No such planning is at present being undertaken by the United Nations. I propose, the President, distinguished delegates, for your consideration, that some such study should be undertaken immediately, and that an international team of scientists, technicians, and administrators should be formed under the United Nations auspices to produce a plan to show what could in fact be done with the resources which are at present being wasted in armaments. In the meantime, of course, it is essential that we on the African continent take positive steps to isolate ourselves as far as possible from the effects of nuclear weapons. One of the first and most practical steps which could be taken in this regard is to prevent any state having nuclear weapons from possessing military bases on the African continent. This is one of the main reasons why the government of Ghana believes that no African state should enter into an alliance of a military nature with any outside power. Any such alliance not only involves the state concerned in the risk of being drawn into nuclear weapons, also endangers the security of the neighboring African state. Fallout is no respecter of frontiers, and a declaration of neutrality cannot save the people of any African state from nuclear poisoning once atomic war is introduced into the African continent. A military alliance with any atomic power is therefore, in the view of the government of Ghana, a threat to the security of Africa and well-being. The government of Ghana therefore feels that it is its duty to support all measures taken within the framework of the United Nations Charter and in collaboration with like-minded African states to prevent the establishment of maintenance of military bases on the African continent. In order to ensure that such bases are not established in Africa, I suggest that an arrangement should be made by the United Nations whereby new states admitted to the organization should register with any treaties they have entered into for their former colonial power. I hope that the great powers who possess atomic weapons will appreciate our feelings in this regard and will voluntarily relinquish any bases that they may have possessed in Africa. I believe that it is the duty of the United Nations to encourage the growth of those free from nuclear warfare. A start in this policy must be made somewhere, and I therefore make a possible positive proposal that whatever other steps will be taken to prevent nuclear disarmament, a start should be made by all nuclear powers agreeing to keep Africa out of their nuclear war plans. Looking at the problem of nuclear disarmament generally, the small nations of the world can make a useful contribution. Since the great powers suspect each other so much, and such inspection on the spot appears to me to be one of the most effective means of obtaining concrete results, these great powers should agree to a system of inspection where the inspection teams only composed of certain members of the small uncommitted nations, which would eliminate our suspicions, create confidence in the inspection work method, and help to solve this crucial and vital issue. And here, I must refer in particular to the question of French atomic tests in the Sahara. The element of French intimidation contained in the text was a positive provocation against Africa and the threat to world peace. We have no doubt that France chose the Sahara to demonstrate to African states their political weakness. This nuclear blackmail brings hope possibly to the independent African states. The importance of creating and maintaining their solidarity against any attack upon the peace and security of the African continent. We cannot ignore the fact that France is military ally to certain other powers, and that in fact, France is only able to carry out these nuclear tests through the support which it receives literally from other nations. We believe that the allies of France will do more than they have done hitherto to dissuade the French government from resuming atomic tests in the Sahara. If anything, they would do would be to offer France the use of their own testing grounds. I hope that when the representatives of the military allies of France come to deal with this particular matter, they will make it perfectly clear that they are opposed to the French atomic test in the Sahara and have done everything possible to stop France from carrying out any further tests. In Africa, we judge the great powers not by their words, but by their actions. We have a right to know which of the great powers support atomic tests on African soil, which of them oppose these tests, and perhaps more important than anything else in assessing the situation, which of the great powers hold African opinion in so little regard that though in their heart they oppose the French action, they are prepared to sacrifice African friendship for the interest of appeasing French pride and ambition.
And we're listening to the historic speech of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the President of the First Republic of Ghana, on October 25th of 1960, before the United Nations General Assembly. He just dealt with the whole question of nuclear testing in Africa, which France carried out in 1960 in the Sahara, right in the midst of the war against the national liberation struggle in Algeria. Right now, Nkrumah will discuss the situation in Korea, Vietnam, and China.
Mr. President, distinguished delegates, one of the most interesting facts of political evolution in Asia is that the old relationship between East and West is gone. Whatever this relationship was, whether it was exploitation or paternalism, is no longer consistent with the new sense of dominant nationalism mission. This is an important background from which to consider the problem of pacification, unification, and containment which have emerged in Korea and Vietnam. In the case of Korea, it is now of great interest to carry the Indian Prime Minister's brief against advancing the United Nations forces beyond the divided line of the 38th parallel after the North Koreans have been driven back to their own domain. The Indian Prime Minister was extremely critical of the unfortunate disposition of the Western powers towards making decisions affecting Asia without a full understanding of the mind and sentiments of its peoples. How right it was has been demonstrated by recent events. It is possible even now to resolve this intractable problem by having general elections in Korea. The situation in Vietnam is too well known to need recapitulation here. shall never be invited a prison to push our obligation. That remains unfulfilled in regard to the question of unifying the army to Vietnam. As a result of the army's strike at the 1984 Geneva Conference, it was agreed that the elections were to be held within 2 years within the object of recreating a unified government of Vietnam. When, however, the so-called chairman of the Geneva Conference, namely the United Kingdom and the USSR, met in 1956, the elections were postponed. They have not yet been held. These countries will no longer submit to political subjection in any form. In the interest of world peace, we ask that elections to be held as soon as possible. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, while on Asian problems, I feel constrained to pass a few remarks on the continued existence of the People's Republic of China outside the framework of the United Nations. The government of Ghana has always supported the view that the People's Republic of China should be admitted to the United Nations so that the representation of China in this assembly can be more realistic and more effective and useful. We believe that the People's Republic of China represented some 650 million people and with vast economic, scientific and technological resources that she is rapidly developing can have a useful and constructive contribution to make towards the maintenance of peace and the advancement of civilization in our time. The issue of whether China should be admitted to the United Nations or not should, I submit, be determined on the basis of principles rather than of experience. It would be unfortunate to underestimate the force of the socialist revolution that has taken place in China. And China is convinced, therefore, that any attempt to impose a form of radical isolation on the People's Republic of China is bound to prove abortive in the long run. Mr. President, it's your wish. Let me now turn to the Middle East. I do so because we in Africa have a vested interest in international peace and security, and we view with considerable concern problems in that part of the world likely to affect said peace and security. The Middle East covers an area of a little over 3.5 million square miles and possesses vast oil resources, which make that region both economically important and politically vulnerable. From the foundation of the Roman Empire, the Middle East has been of great commercial significance, and presidential efforts have been made by various countries to control and profit from the petroleum deposits in the area. However, the real danger to international peace is the attempt made by vested interests to prevent the inhabitants and others from profiting by the natural wealth of the region. It is the view of the Ghana government, therefore, that the Western powers, which are the principal consumers of oil from the Middle East, have a vital obligation to safeguard the peace and political equilibrium of the area. As long as these powers continue to exploit the oil resources of the Middle East on a competitive basis, the friction resulting from a crash of the economic and commercial interests is not to endanger the peace of mankind. It is my view that the time has come for the supreme effort to be made at an international level to reduce the fever and heat of tensions in this part of the world. And I would propose that the United Nations should consider as a matter of urgency inviting the various states in the Middle East to provide a just and permanent solution to these problems. It seems to me that the most vital question would be to find out how big the petroleum deposit of the region could be exploited on a non-competitive basis for the development of the Middle East and for feeding the productive capacity of industrialized countries for the benefit of mankind. If this were done, the existing tension between East and West would be significantly reduced.
for the important that with the invention of long-range ballistic missiles and other forms of nuclear weapons, the importance of the Middle East as a place for any struggle for the mastery of the world has been greatly minimized. Nevertheless, even when this clash of economic interest has been removed, there still remains the pending issues of Arab-Israel relations in the Middle East. This is one of the thorniest problems facing this world organization. And unless a permanent and realistic solution is found, the danger of it developing into armed conflict, it remains. The solution of the Middle East question lies in the recognition of the political realities there. In light of this, I submit that the United Nations should set up a committee to study and evolve the machinery in which it would be impossible either for Israel to attack any of the Arab states or for the Arab states to attack Israel, and for some sort of arrangement to be made to keep the whole world out of the Middle East.
And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, and right now we're moving into the concluding remarks of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the President of the First Republic of Ghana, in his historic speech before the United Nations General Assembly on October 25th of 1960. In his concluding remarks, Dr. Nkrumah talks about the threat of neocolonialism in Africa.
Mr. President, Mr. Wish, I must bring the intelligence to make a few concluding observations by way of emphasis on the African question. For a long time, Africa has been subjected to a harsh form of colonialism. In consequence, there is now a more strong, powerful, and possibly for the in Africa against this system. I think that the upheaval in the Congo is a manifestation of that rebellion. The responsibility for keeping the Cold War out of the Congo, and for that matter, out of Africa, rests equally on the United Nations. This responsibility, as far as the Congo is concerned, can only be discharged if the United Nations act promptly and realistically in the present situation there. It is impossible to ignore the realities of the continued Belgian intervention in the Congo in defiance of the Security Council resolution. Unless such intervention is promptly and effectively checked, and the private armies of all sorts now operate in the Congo, eliminated by the United Nations, there will be no end to the chaos and confusion which now brings the new state. It is impossible for a state to be neutral on the issue of good and evil, as it is for the United Nations to be neutral on the issue of legality and illegality. The United Nations must determine what is lawful and what is right, and then see that this is enforced. Otherwise, the United Nations will betray the principles which were proclaimed in the first resolution of the Security Council, on the basis of which the legitimate government invited them to enter the Congo Republic. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, knowing the situation in the Congo as I do, and in order to save the Congo from chaos and confusion, from strife and political and economic instability, to drive the Cold War out of Africa, save the reputation of the United Nations itself, safeguard the legitimate government which invited the United Nations to the Congo, I strongly recommend the United Nations the adoption of certain measures which I am sure will definitely provide the only solution to the present impasse in the Congo. In proposing these recommendations, I wish to take this opportunity of expressing my personal appreciation of the way in which the General Secretary has handled the most difficult task. and my own personal belief in the ideas of the United Nations Charter, which constitutes in our time the strongest bulwark for international peace and security. As the recommendations of the government of Ghana. That the United Nations command in the Congo should be changed forthwith and a firm, strong command established with clear, positive directions to support the legitimate government with Kasavubu as president and Lumumba as prime minister. And whose jurisdictions should be recognized throughout the whole of Congo Republic. In other words, the present composition of the United Nations command should be changed, and the composition of the United Nations force, its military command, and administration altered, so that it is drawn entirely from contingents of the forces of the independent African states serving the Congo. That every support to be given to the central government as the legitimate government of the Congo with the full support of the United Nations. That all private armies, including the American officer forces in Katanga, should be disarmed forthwith, and the Congolese National Army be recruited and reorganized for the purpose of training so that ultimately it can play its proper role as the National Army of the Congo Republic on the same time that the central government consider it possible to dispense with the services of the United Nations. Four, that this new command of the United Nations forces should support the central government to restore law and order in the Congo in accordance with the first resolution of the Security Council, in reliance on which Ghana and other independent African states take their contingents on the United Nations command. Five, that the United Nations should guarantee the territorial integrity of the Republic of Congo in accordance with the provisions of the Constitution agreed at that time, at the time of independence. Six, that all financial aid and technical assistance to the Congo Republic should be arranged only with the legitimate government of the Congo Republic and channeled through the United Nations and guaranteed and supervised by a committee of independent African states appointed by the Security Council and who should be accountable to the United Nations. Mr. President, this is what I must now thank you for the patience with which you have listened to me and also for the honor of this opportunity of addressing you.
And welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And we just heard the historic speech of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah in its entirety before the United Nations General Assembly on October 25th, 1960. He addressed a number of issues, the legacy of colonialism and racism in Africa, the Congo crisis, the then ongoing situation involving national oppression and settler colonialism in southern Africa, the Algerian war of national liberation against French imperialism, the problems of peace and disarmament as it relates to the African continent, the ongoing struggle at that time with reference to Korea, Vietnam, and the People's Republic of China, the struggle within the Middle East, also his concluding remarks related to the rise of neocolonialism and the role of the United Nations in Africa, and also some specific recommendations on the part of the government of Ghana at the time to the United Nations as an international body. And right now we're going to be winding down our program for this week. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Albayomi Ezekwe.
Today, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Journal will be available via podcast on the Fight for Truth Blog Talk Radio website. All you have to do is log on to the Fight for Truth website and scroll down to the Pan-African Journal for today, July 7th, 2012. And you can, of course, listen to this program again. Also, share this program in various means. So right now, we're going to conclude this program for this week. We'll be back next week with more of Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Azikwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week.
Thank you. Thank you.